you and kpfk.org.
Hey, it's Jerry Goldstein, producer, co-writer of the band War, and I want us all to show some love to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles.
KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles and kpfk.org worldwide. This is Michael O'Keefe. Listen up. This is important stuff.
This is Feminist Magazine, a weekly radical radio show and podcast produced by a diverse collective of feminists. And every week we bring you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And I'm Lynn Harris-Ballin, your host today, and this is what feminism can sound like. It's been a roller coaster legal week for abortion care. And if you just maybe heard a headline that said the Supreme Court just temporarily restored access to the abortion pill mifepristone by mail for now, you may be confused. But we have somebody with us today, Alisa Wells, who is the co-founder and access director of Plan C. And she's going to give us some background, some info, some sense of where we are and what we should be worried about. So welcome to Feminist Magazine, Alisa.
Thanks for having me.
So let's just quickly start for our listeners who might not be familiar with Plan C. What is Plan C? How long have you been around? And what are sort of your core goals?
We've been around for about 12 years. We launched our website 10 years ago. And we've been working on the transformative power of abortion pills and how those pills might be put more directly in the hands of the person who's seeking an abortion. We've known for decades that these pills are safe and effective. And we asked the question, you know, how could these be made more available? So we started doing research on how the pills are available, and we started sharing that research on our website so that people knew where they could go for reliable, safe, self-managed abortion. And since then, Roots of Access have just blossomed. We worked a lot on telehealth access during the pandemic to put forth a new model of less medicalized access, which has grown and is now providing about 30% of all abortions nationwide. And we've highlighted some of the self-managed options that are available, including community networks, international suppliers, and also websites that sell pills.
Right. And it's just all basically been an education process, really, in so many ways, because it seems like this has been available for a while, but awareness has just shifted, or perhaps need, because of all of the recent legal changes.
There absolutely is a lot of communication and awareness building that is happening now. 5 years ago, you really couldn't get an abortion by mail, or it was a foreign concept. You know, this idea that you can get an abortion in the mail is something that's really a radical idea, right? And a lot of people come to our website and they see what we say are these routes of access, and they say, is this legit? And it is. Yes, it is. Everything that we have on our website are legitimate, tested, vetted, and safe ways of obtaining abortion pills. And I think the real game changer in all of this has been the abortion pill itself. We've known since they were first approved in France in 1988 that they're a safe and effective medication. And we've known that they've been overregulated and kept out of reach in the United States too. First of all, the U.S. was late to approving them. It wasn't until the year 2000, 12 years after they were approved in France, that we got access to them in the United States. And when we did get access, it was restricted. And that's what this current court case is about. It's about further restricting access to these pills. The case is asking the FDA or the government to say that these pills can't be made available through the mail. And that would be a huge blow to access, because 30% of all abortions now in the United States are done using telehealth with pills put in the mail directly to the abortion seeker.
And mostly that is because so many states have effectively outlawed abortion.
Well, this current case is coming from the state of Louisiana. They are saying that because providers are mailing pills into Louisiana, where they have had a state law that bans abortion care in Louisiana, that they are facing harms. And the way that pills are coming into Louisiana is because in many states in the country, like New York, California, Washington, Massachusetts, and others, these liberal states have passed laws that offer protections to clinicians who are doing telehealth and telehealth abortion. So these clinicians sitting in those protective states feel confident that they will be protected in their medical practice if they offer care to patients from the restrictive states who are asking for help getting abortion care. So these amazing clinicians, and there's a whole network of them that's serving the entire country, are shipping abortion pills into restricted states like Louisiana, Alabama, Texas, and wherever there are barriers to access. This is safe. This is effective. The research shows that there's no harm being done or any kind of medical safety risk that's involved in this. So we have very clear evidence that there's not, you know, nothing wrong from a medical perspective from doing this. But because it's going around the restrictions that Louisiana has put in place, Louisiana is trying to stop it through this lawsuit.
What seems absolutely confusing is why the Louisiana case would then affect the entire country. That's the jump that I think a lot of folks don't understand.
Yeah, it's very complicated. The way that this was introduced and the fact that it's called Louisiana versus the FDA would make it seem like it is only going to apply to access in Louisiana, which is already restricted. But that is not at all the case. It applies to the federal regulation of mifepristone, which is one of the two pills used in medication abortion. So the state of Louisiana is challenging the way FDA regulates mifepristone, and they're challenging the fact that it changed its regulation in 2001 to enable the pills to be mailed. Originally, the FDA had restricted the use of mifepristone to in-person dispensing. And so, you know, despite the total safety of these medications that we've known for decades, there were over-medicalized restrictions put on how it could be dispensed. So you had to go to a clinic, you had to meet with a provider, and you had to get the pills in the clinic. And you could still take them home and use them. Although at one point you had to take them in front of the provider,
wow,
which is ridiculous. But anyway, that all changed in 2001. And also under a judge's order in 2000, they said that during the COVID pandemic emergency, that people could send them through the mail and they could also collaborate with online pharmacies to mail them. And of course, that was a huge breakthrough during the pandemic because people couldn't travel. There were states saying that abortion wasn't essential health care. You could not even travel to a clinic to get care. It was, you know, you remember it was pandemonium back then. But that was also an opportunity for us to push forward this new method of telehealth and get providers engaged in providing telehealth care across the country. And then it was in 2003 that these telehealth providers who had been serving all of the less restrictive states with telehealth care, telehealth abortion, they started operating under shield laws in these protective states and serving the entire country.
Right. So it wasn't the FDA, but in fact, pharmaceutical companies who took this case to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has now put a 1 week stay on this. Are they going to have hearings? The stay seems to be until May 11th, right? So we're sort of, again, in this limbo moment. And I'm seeing online folks posting things saying, get your supply now, which is wild. But they seem to have a long shelf life. But essentially, what do we think is going to happen? I mean, who is going to be fighting on our behalf is also the question.
Right. The case was originally brought against the FDA, challenging the FDA's regulation. And it's my understanding that then two of the distributors, Danco and Gen BioPro, joined that suit so that then they could have a voice as well. And so now we have the Supreme Court that has put a stay on the Fifth Circuit of Appeals Court decision that would have prohibited the mailing of mifepristone. So we have a little bit of a reprieve right now. The court has asked for briefings to be submitted by Thursday. So it's possible that as soon as Thursday, we might have additional decisions coming from the Supreme Court, or Friday, or sometime next week. It's unclear when that will happen. But what we want people to know is that regardless of what happens, there will still be telehealth abortion available in all 50 states. It might be still with mifepristone, but it's possible that many of the providers that are out there providing this telehealth abortion care across the country will pivot to a different set of pills that they will use. They most likely would pivot to using misoprostol only. That is the second of the two pills that is usually used for an abortion with pills. And it's safe. It's effective. This misoprostol-only regimen has been used around the world for decades. And in fact, it is the set of drugs that women discovered back in the 1980s was effective for having an abortion. They saw the labeling on a common ulcer drug, Cytotec, and on the label, it showed a pregnant person with their red circle and a line drawn through it saying, do not use while you're pregnant because, you know, this could cause a miscarriage. And they thought, wow, okay, it could cause a miscarriage. And they started experimenting with it. And it was these networks of people in Brazil and in other Latin American countries that started testing out, taking the pills when they were pregnant, figuring out how much they needed to take, and then sharing that information with other women that actually developed this method of abortion, which we now might be using more consistently in the United States if access to mifepristone goes away.
Thank you for the background story. I had never heard that one before. And of course, it was a network of women taking their health care into their own hands, because we always have to do it that way, right?
Yeah. And speaking of networks, that is another way that the pills are available in the United States right now. In addition to the telehealth providers that are licensed U.S. providers and that have been shipping mifepristone plus misoprostol and might start shipping only the misoprostol, there are three other ways of getting pills in the United States that we have tested, we have researched at Plan C and found to be reliable and safe. And one of those is community networks, peer-to-peer support networks that are getting access to abortion pills, mifepristone plus misoprostol. These are generic products from India. They're getting access to them in this country, and then they are taking requests from people who are seeking help, and they will ship the pills for free to anybody who requests them who can't afford to access pills in other ways. So these community networks, there are two main ones in the United States, Red State Access and DASH. We list them on our website, and they are a lifeline to many people who are needing support. They also provide accompaniment, which is another form of care that was pioneered in Latin American countries by women to help each other. And the accompaniment, you know, way back when was in person, but now there's virtual accompaniment using secure communication methods, texting or phone. These folks that operate these community networks can help talk you through or text you through what to expect and how to get help if you need it. So that's one of the ways that pills are available. And then there's two others. One is through international telehealth services that operate overseas. They ship, again, generic products manufactured in India, and they, you know, arrive quite quickly. They do have a little bit of a medical intake form that you fill out. There is a doctor behind both of the services that we list on our website now. And they're, you know, they're great services, also provide follow-up advice and information if you need it. And then the third way is through what we call websites that sell pills, just commercial businesses that are selling abortion pills on the internet. We've been researching these since 2013 and have test purchased from them over the years. And at times we've done some laboratory testing of the products that we've received. They were real pills, and we have no concerns about anything that somebody might receive from these businesses that we have been vetting for the last 13 years.
That's really amazing and also encouraging, because I think that hasn't really been covered in mainstream media coverage of the story. So I'm really glad to be able to share that with our listeners. So abortion pills have basically disrupted anti-choice efforts to ban abortion in the U.S. It seems like Louisiana is the new thin end of the wedge, right? That they're like, oh, obviously these crafty women have found a way around this, and now we're going to attack this new area. Is that also the feeling on your end?
Yeah, it's fun to be called a crafty woman. So first of all,
I would take it as a compliment.
Our sense is that we are winning the access war because we have developed all of these systems of access. And, you know, in the case of Plan C, we have illuminated them for people. We put the word out through our website, through social media and other types of campaigns to draw attention to them. And so all of this movement wide, you know, has built this strong, robust network of access that is really upending the anti-choice movement's tactics that they have used, which have been to protest in person at clinics, mm-hmm. And also to force policy that will prevent access, right? So this current court case is an attempt to control policy in a way that would take away a major route of access, major form of access to these pills. And it is just the beginning, or, you know, a continuation of their attempts to totally ban abortion everywhere, not just in their states where they have these really conservative beliefs and they impose them on their populations, even though the populations are mostly pro-choice, mm-hmm. right? But the politicians are out there, the patriarchy is out there trying to take away the rights of individuals to what should be basic health care and what is basic health care in many parts of the country. And now they're trying this tactic to take it away, not only in their own states, but everywhere for this one particular medication. Fortunately, as we've discussed, there are other medications that can be used, not just misoprostol only, but some others too that providers are looking at. And we know that they will not win this, that these pills are so safe, so effective, and so readily available around the world and through the global economic network mm-hmm. off the internet, that they cannot be stopped. We call these pills unstoppable. So that is the hopeful message that we have. And also that they're so safe and so effective that people can just take them if they need them. All you need to know is when you last had your period and whether you have, you know, any bleeding disorders. There's plenty of information online about how you can take these things safely. We tend to think of self-managed abortion in terms of the olden days,
right?
Prior to Roe, where of course, you know, self-managed abortion was unsafe. But with the advent of abortion pills, they are a transformational technology that is enabling people to really have control over their reproduction in a very safe way. So that's the message that we want people to hear, and come to plancpills.org to learn more about what those options are. Now, you had also mentioned, do you think people are buying these pills in advance to get prepared? And yes, we do. We know they are. We absolutely know that people come to our website every time there is some egregious court decision, like the fall of Roe when the Dobbs decision hit. Our web traffic was through the roof. And we know from talking to providers that so many people came to them and said, I want to get abortion pills now because I want to be prepared. In the same way that we have Band-Aids in our medicine cabinets, because you never know when you're going to start bleeding, right? People are buying abortion pills to have on hand, either for themselves or for a loved one. Mm-hmm. And this, you know, this is happening all over the country. It's been happening in the restrictive states for a long time. And now I think with this news and this possibility that mifepristone could be restricted nationally, more people are waking up to that idea that this might be good for them to do as well.
Right. It sounds like a smart idea. And even creating your own networks, you know, among your group of friends or for younger friends. And for many of us, I think would be definitely something to have in your back pocket, so to speak. We've been talking to Alisa Wells, who is the co-founder and access director of Plan C. And Alisa, what were your next goals before this whole dramatic crisis happened? Where was Plan C moving towards at that point?
Well, our goals and our strategy remarkably have not changed that much since we first started working on this. We always knew that the strength of the technology and just sharing information about its availability would be the way to transform access and sort of create a new model of care in the United States for abortion. And so we continue to help people understand that the pills are available, that they're safe and that they're effective, and envision a future in which they are even more directly in the hands of the person who needs them. So from day one, we have talked about over-the-counter access. Having access directly off of pharmacy shelves is already happening in many countries globally. There are social marketing programs that sell packet of pills that they're packaged as one mifepristone and four misoprostol, just in a little blister pack in the pharmacy. And in fact, that's one of our origin stories, is that I was in Ethiopia with Francine Koito, who I've done a lot of work with, and she and I sent our local colleague into the drugstore and said, "See if you can buy abortion pills." And our colleague came out, you know, 5 or 10 minutes later, and after spending $5 or $6, had a packet of abortion pills. And it was just so astounding to us at the time that access to abortion pills was that easy in Ethiopia. And yet in the United States, politicians were already starting to impose more and more restrictions, particularly in Texas, which has led the way in restrictions to abortion. And we thought, you know, how is it that we in the United States are so far behind on this model of better access to this safe and effective drug? And that's in part what spurred us on to start Plan C.
Amazing how the inspiration came to you. You were like, we have to do this ourselves, is basically what happened. If you could give our listeners once again your website in terms of resources so that they can have them in case they missed them the first time around.
Our website is plancpills.org, and when somebody goes there, they can just put their state in the search field and find out all the ways that abortion pills are available and accessible, including telehealth, which is online clinics that have U.S. licensed providers who are supplying FDA-approved products using evidence-based protocols. There are international telehealth providers who are also supported by doctors and using evidence-based protocols and generic products from India. There are community networks, so there's this peer-to-peer support network that are providing generic pills from India. And then there are commercial businesses that sell on the internet, so they also provide generic pills from India.
Yeah, your website is actually amazing.
Thank you. We just won a Webby Award.
It's so clear. It's fantastic.
There are also a lot of resources that we list on our website. I'm going to mention a few of them that are really an amazing part of the ecosystem of access in the United States right now. One is the Miscarriage and Abortion Hotline, mahotline.org. They are a group of volunteer clinicians who provide free information about medical issues you might be experiencing. So they are open not quite 24 hours, but a lot of hours. You can call them or text them and they will answer your questions and help you know if you need to take extra misoprostol or seek urgent care. But in most cases, they're going to be able to reassure you and help you find the care that you need. The second resource is ReproCare, which is a peer-to-peer support network for emotional support and information. That's reprocare.com. And the third very important resource is the Repro Legal Helpline. This is a free legal information source where if people have questions about the legality of what they're doing in their state, they can reach out to the reprolegalhelpline.org and get free information from that group. So all of these things make an amazing supportive ecosystem for people who are in need of abortion care, but might, in particular, those that might live in a state that restricts access to it. So we don't want anybody to feel like they don't have access and support to safe abortion care in the United States because of the horrible actions that legislatures and courts are doing right now to try and restrict access to care. Abortion pills are everywhere in all 50 states, even states with bans, and it is possible to get a safe abortion and even a free abortion in the United States right now.
Thank you so much for joining us today and bringing us all this really important information and a sense of clarity about what's going on. But more than anything, a feeling of we still have the power and the hope and the accessibility, basically, for anyone who might need reproductive care. Alisa Wells, who is co-founder and access director of Plan C, thank you again.
Thanks for having me.
You can support KPFK and our show today, Feminist Magazine. Just go to the kpfk.org website and click the donate button. It's easy. Or you can call 818-985-5735 or 818-985-KPFK. If you do that right now, your conscience is clear. You have done it for this fund drive, and then you can go back to listening to the rest of the show. And that is just one example of the kind of story we love to highlight. And also feminist artists and creatives, plus, of course, local activists telling you ways that you can take action and make a difference yourself. And you can support us to keep us doing that right now. You can call 818-985-5735 or 818-985-KPFK.
It's Lupe. I listen to you guys every morning, and I've been listening to you guys since I was 19 years old. I listen to Democracy Now! And the one in the afternoon, I always forget. Background briefing. There you go. Yeah, that
one. All right, Lupe.
As a KPFK listener, you expect to hear smart conversations about important issues every time you turn on the radio. We bring you facts and analysis, not partisanship or hype, so you can form your own opinions on the news. You count on KPFK for informed, insightful reporting. Don't take coverage like this for granted. It's here for you, thanks to the generous financial support of our listeners. Support the programming you rely on right now by calling 818-985-5735 or contribute online at kpfk.org.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And coming up next...
For me, as a paraplegic, this wheelchair is an extension of my body, not just a mobility device. And I think a lot of people can't grasp the concept that when you grab a person's wheelchair... who uses a wheelchair all day, every day, you're grabbing their body.
What happens to a disabled body that does not produce at the rate of capitalism? It becomes ejected. It becomes labeled as deficient and inefficient against a system that is totally arbitrary and are absolutely external to the life of the body.
On today's episode, Disability, Our Culture, Ourselves, we'll take you on a bus ride in Seattle to experience a day in the life of a disabled passenger. And we'll hear from Sarah Acevedo, a disability studies scholar who explores culture and identity from within the disabled community.
When I claim or tell someone, oh, I'm autistic, and they're like, don't you mean you have autism? Because, like, you're a human first. And so that makes me think what autistic people are inhuman inherently.
That was Professor Acevedo. Now let's hear from disability rights activist Dorian Taylor and the particular challenges they face while accessing public transportation as a paraplegic. Here's contributor Mona Yeh with the report.
I know. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Mona Yeh. That was Dorian Taylor getting on a bus with me. We rode from Dorian's home in Tukwila to the South Downtown neighborhood in Seattle. Dorian is paraplegic and a wheelchair user due to a traumatic incident with police 5 years ago. Dorian moved to Seattle to seek better medical services and is now training for competitive sprint kayaking. Here's the dispatch.
To get the training, I travel from Tukwila to Bothell. It's about a 2-hour trip one way. I don't drive. Access is also very unreliable, so I catch the bus for everything. I do most of my own grocery shopping, go to doctor's appointments. It's my main method of transportation besides my wheelchair. For me, as a paraplegic, this wheelchair is an extension of my body. It's not just a mobility device. It was literally, specifically built for my paralysis level, for my sensation. And I think a lot of people can't grasp the concept that when you grab a person's wheelchair who uses a wheelchair all day, every day, you're grabbing their body. You're grabbing their physical person. I get a lot of that. Like, people will just grab me and drag me. Passengers, when I speak up about this, bus drivers tend to ignore it because they're just trying to help. And as a female assigned person, that puts me in a tricky situation because I've had people that weren't just trying to help. And I don't get the same amount of protection as anybody else. The chances are they're going to defend the person that grabbed me. We're not used to seeing people with physical disabilities be independent. That reflects on the policies of Metro, and it reflects on how somebody like myself, who is pretty independent and can strap themselves in and all this, it's how we're treated on the bus. So people don't act like I know what I'm doing. They act like they're going to know my mobility aid or how to strap it on better than me. I think a lot of people also don't realize how much these cost. This is $6,000. Just the cushion alone is $700. This seat back's $800. That alone should be a reason why a bus driver should just listen to you when you're talking about your mobility aid. An electric chair, you're looking at $30,000 or $40,000. I need this. Like, this is my everything, you know? It's considered damage to private property. It's not considered bodily injury. But if you break my wheelchair, I feel like you injured my body because you've literally destroyed my mobility. You've destroyed the ability for me to just go to the bathroom without crawling. It's really hard to explain to bus drivers that not every single chair is the same. Not every single wheelchair user is the same. Like, you don't have the same mobility as she does, so why would I have the same mobility and the same needs as the next person whose wheelchair is like you can buy at Walgreens? I've had bus drivers, I'll let myself unstrap myself, go up to the edge of the, to wait for them to put the ramp down. I've had bus drivers grab me by the chest, like I'm just going to roll off the bus while they're in the middle of putting the ramp down. And I had a bus driver literally tell me, well, I'm just doing my job. And I said, so your job is to grab people and treat them like children? You know, I've got left before to the point that when I used to catch the 120 downtown, houseless people would stand in front of me to make sure I got on the bus because they got tired of seeing me left. I've had a bus driver pass me up at the bus stop because he wasn't looking down. And then stop, but tell me I couldn't get on because he didn't want to let the ramp down in the grass. And this is the same bus driver that refused to tell a blind person where their stop was because they didn't have a white cane, you know. And it's such an issue. When I started working with the Transit Riders Union and reading the policies, well, the problem is in the policies. When first of all, they basically tell somebody, tell the bus drivers, you know, you need to make sure this person is safe, but there's never anything about consent. There's never anything about the person might know their safety better than the next person. When I lived in Portland, and when I was in New York City, you actually have the option of whether or not you can strap yourself in, because in reality, it's actually really dangerous for me, for my chair to be strapped in. Because if the bus gets in a wreck, I'm just going to fly out of my chair. If I was just locked with my wheel locks, I'd be fine. Like, that's how I rode in New York. That's how I rode in Portland. But here, it's actually really unsafe, and it's causing all of this damage to my wheelchair on top of it. Damage to the alignment, replacing screws and bolts and things like that. Your only other option, if you don't want to fly out of your chair, is to be restrained. That's where you got straps, so I couldn't even, like, grab what I needed to grab to take care of myself. So that's not an option either. The main problem I feel with the policy is they glance over it And there's no actual training on how to interact with people with physical disabilities. And if you see the way people with physical disabilities are treated in our society in general, we're infantilized in a lot of ways. So the problem that we get with teaching it as an afterthought, and there being absolutely no consent in the policy, and the policy itself being really patronizing, we have these different interpretations. So you have a bus driver that will let you on first, let you strap yourself in. You have bus drivers that lie to me and tell me that the policy and how you strap yourself in is completely different. Like, oh, you have to strap yourself this way and that way. Yesterday, I get on the bus. He strapped my tire both here and here on the hand rims. First of all, this is quick release. So that's like the most dangerous place to lock up your chair. So I told him, I said, oh, next time, could you not strap that here? Because just so you know, that's a really unsafe place to strap wheelchairs, especially everyday wheelchairs. And I showed him this. And then he started giving me hassle. And then I noticed that my wheels had been a little wobbly. So I was like pushing off the bus. And I was like, look, I'm the one that ends up paying for the damage. And these wheels cost $700. Then he tells me, you just tell me how to strap it up. And I was like, you know, actually, next time I ride your bus, I'll strap myself on, save the hassles. And he told me straight up, the next time you get on my bus, I'm not letting you on. And that's actually a pretty mild incident. But what had me call is I went to push up the hill and my tires are wobbly because they were pulled by the here. These are $700 rims. I cannot afford new wheels. Because of how I end up paralyzed, I've got pretty bad PTSD and people grabbing me, you know, without my permission, it sets that off. So I'm not in a good mood when I ride the bus. And I have to prepare myself mentally to be able to catch the bus. And I have all my things on my person, like super close. I make sure that there's nothing that would even make anybody want to just reach out and grab me. Like, I try to make sure, like, everything is just in order so no one would touch me. All right. No, that was golden.
We were fortunate enough to have a hassle-free experience on this bus ride. However, Dorian's reality is that every day and every ride is unpredictable. Before leaving the house, Dorian has to mentally prepare for the ride. Amidst constant healthcare trips, the long commutes from Tukwila to Bothell for kayaking offer critical value to Dorian's life.
I just needed something. I was going to snap. I was going to lose it. That's how I got involved in sports, and that's why I like kayaking so much, because it's the only place I can be where I don't think about all of that.
That was a ride-along with Dorian Taylor. Dorian is currently working on communicating with Metro Services to find ways they can better serve individuals with disabilities. Dorian is carrying forward the efforts of the disability rights movement that began in the 1960s and continues today. The main slogan of that movement is, "Nothing about us without us," meaning no policy should be decided without the full and direct participation of those affected by that policy. Up next, we'll hear disability studies scholar Sarah Acevedo.
Everything disability is grassroots. Just think about that. Like, the history of disability rights in the first place is grassroots. Like, people climbing the Capitol steps, throwing themselves out of their wheelchairs, throwing their crutches, climbing those steps, invading, like, sort of occupying, right? Those were people, everyday disabled people who were being intently marginalized from every aspect of everyday life. And sort of like how disability studies kind of was born out of those grassroots struggles and became institutionalized. As it so happens that grassroots knowledge becomes institutionalized and co-opted and sort of reinvented or reincorporated into this wheel of reproduction, not only in terms of like reproducing exchangeable goods. We understand education as an exchangeable good, right? Which is a heartache. But also in terms of like this absorption of knowledge knowledges in plural, turning it into this top-down approach to, oh, this is like the seriousness of the fact because we have put it in an academic book, right? And I am not whatsoever excusing myself from that because I am very much a part of it. I reproduce disability as anybody else who studies disability as a disabled person. And let me tell you, as a disabled person, I prefer to be studied by, obviously I want to study alongside somebody. I rather that disability issues are taken up by disabled academics. Let me tell you the truth. And as much as I wish, for instance, that I could go to therapy and my therapist was autistic, you know, sort of like entering. And so disability studies is kind of in this like sort of like sort of strategic infiltration space of like, let's legitimize our grassroots struggles and like sort of institutionalize them so that they are recognized within this sort of like matrix of dominant knowledge and sort of like ways of producing knowledge that are considered legitimate because they have a seal, because they're accredited, right? And so doing, there is a process of separation of disability studies from disability grassroots struggles. Like there's no doubt that that occurs. It occurs with anthropology, it occurs with sociology, right? And with many other disciplines. So, and I'm telling you all this because I wanna talk about a model of understanding disability, the disability experience that was emerged from the work of disabled grassroots activists in Britain in the 1970s, and that they were working together, so disabled activists who were living in the community with disabled people who were still institutionalized and being brutalized and dehumanized within institutions of care for the disabled. So working in collaboration, they started thinking about the ways in which society disables different bodies.
You can support KPFK and our show today, Feminist Magazine, or you can call 818-985-5735 or 818-985-KPFK. And that is just one example of the kind of story we love to highlight. Feminist Magazine brings you voices like that, and also feminist artists and creatives. That is what we actually mean when we say at the top of our show every week that we're bringing you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. And you can support us to keep us doing that right now. You can just go to the kpfk.org website and click the donate button. You can give $25, $50, $100, or become a sustaining member. We want to be a sustainable radio station. And so if you just give us your credit card, we do a monthly payment. And then it's a sustainable way to keep bringing you these stories.
Hey, this is Wanda Sykes, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles. And if you'd like to shell out a few bucks, you know, keep us up and running so I can have nice conversation in a cool voice like this. Pick up the phone and call 818-985-5735. That's 818-985-KPFK. Thank you.
You're listening to Feminist Magazine on KPFK on 90.7 FM and kpfk.org. I'm your host today, Lynn Harris-Ballin. And coming up next...
Right, so there's an active process that happens, and that process is called the process of disablement, right? So those like given fancy terms were brought into academia by disabled British sociologists, drawing from these experiences of grassroots struggles and brought it to bear onto this model that had prevailed the history of any study of disability. Not disability studies. That's different. any study of disability, about disability, on disability without disabled people. It's known in disability studies as the biomedical or individual model of disability, which understands disabled bodies as inherently individually deficient. So it is a problem. It's an inherent problem of the body. It has nothing to do with the societal circumstances, ideologies, practices, attitudes, institutional approaches to different embodiment, right? No, the disability is just a natural, organic occurrence, and it's a deficit. Needs to be cured, needs to be hidden, needs to be manicured, needs to be prostheticized, needs to be handled, needs to be observed in confinement. Right? So this has been the tradition, right? The long Western tradition of understanding and managing and administering the disabled body through a biomedical perspective. That, unfortunately, is the perspective that continues to prevail today after 40, 50 years of struggles by disabled people, grassroots academics, in collaboration, artists, performers, poets, you name it. There is still this understanding of disability from this deficit perspective. So these academics, like this British sociologist, were trying to be like, look, these people on the ground, they talked about a social perspective of disability, which locates the problem outside the body. It is not different embodiment. It is not the different body, different, that also in quotation marks, that's inherently problematic, that's inherently burdensome, or that's inherently abnormal, right? It is actually the social structures, practices, policies, institutions, interpersonal relationships that produce disability into a category of deficiency, and therefore a category of social oppression in every aspect of life, right? So in doing so, this battle sort of begun, right? It was like disabled intellectuals fighting against the rest of the world in terms of like this academic traditions and like schools of thought that had been like totally established in disabled academics and intellectuals, not even disability studies yet, but just like within sociology. We're like, look at us, we're disabled, we're talking to you. And the disciplines were like, you can't possibly be an academic, you can't possibly be an intellectual because you're disabled. So we don't know what you're talking about, right? So it's this power relationship and this imbalance between both two camps, so to speak. And so it happens that the social model has informed so many of our contemporary struggles. It continues to do so because it brings the idea of disability to bear on the material reality, concrete reality of the disabled body, of disabled bodies, in a way that we cease to exist within this Platonic realm of ideas and narratives and metaphor. Because disability is a very useful metaphor, let me tell you. For writers, oh my God, it's like the primer, like, let's go to disability and use all this imagery about collapsing societies through the image of the disabled body, right? In a way as to detach it completely from the realm of material experience. And in doing so, from our lives, from the very experience of disability, from living disability. So living disability is embodying disability, which we do, which disabled people do. We embody that thing. We celebrate that thing. We struggle with that thing. But in insisting on an erasure of disability and disabled people from producing everyday life and from producing the world, that's why we continue to circulate as metaphors, as charity cases are pitiful. That is not how we understand ourselves. That is not how we see ourselves. That is not how we represent ourselves.
disability culture, huge depth, vibrancy, richness, multi-layeredness of experience and deliciousness, and just like multifaceted ways of looking at our bodies in a three-dimensional perspective as opposed to these flat allegories. One of these examples in the Bay, like be proud, Sins Invalid, and Latif is part of Sins Invalid. It is this performance troupe of disabled artists of color centering queer and non and gender non-conforming experiences and bringing sexuality and sensuality in your face. Because the medicalized experience or representation of disability is the perpetual infant body, the non-sexual body, right? That is the mainstream that is completely dissonant with the way we live our lives and experience our bodies as pleasurable. We experience this body, our bodies as pleasurable. We experience our bodies as oppressed. We experience our bodies as interdependent. We experience our bodies as this huge amalgamation of greatness, of possibility, of hope, outside of this binary construction of the deficit and the perfect body. What is the perfect body? What is the able body? Doesn't the able body need the disabled body in order to exist? Doesn't it need to be constructed again, like in tandem? Like, how else do you define an able body? Everything that a disabled body isn't is the able body. So we're still needed. Like, the able body needs us, disabled bodies, to reproduce itself in this hegemonic, hierarchical way. So this division, like, think about the division between normality, quote unquote, and abnormality, which are both historical. They're constructs. Like, abnormality and normality don't just exist in a vacuum of, like, organicity or that's just the way it is. Things are the way they are. Their white supremacy is just a natural occurrence of the hierarchical. You know, like, it isn't. It is a product of social relations that exist within very specific value systems and ideologies. So what I wanted to do today, Moshe, was invite you to, like, really think beyond the binary. To just really dig deeper and look at the contradictions that exist, like, beyond, within, and the outside of those binaries that are so limiting and are so oppressive. So another thing that I see so often with my students and just people in general that's been like a really rich terrain of addressing this from the perspective not of a professor who teaches stuff about disability. No, as a disabled professor who teaches about disability studies, is this an engagement with ableist language, everyday ableist languages. So yes, metaphorical iterations, but in a more sort of like everyday sort of casual way. Oh, the weather is so OCD. That is an insane film. People don't usually think too deeply about the histories that exist behind the usage of these labels and these words. They have a history. Just as much as the construction of normality and abnormality has a history, these words that we use so casually in such arbitrary ways today, that's crazy, OCD, I was blinded by it, I was blind to it, it was a blind spot. You know, it's a crotch. The economy is crippled, which is not the same as reclaiming crip culture, let me tell you. That's a very different iteration right there. There is a history. And the history is a history of brutalization. The brutalization of disabled bodies in the creation of nation states. And the separation of bodies and stratification of bodies again in terms of who belongs and who doesn't belong. I mean, we can't give citizenship to everybody. We gotta create citizenship in a dialectic with non-citizenship, because then how can citizenship exist on its own? We gotta create nationals and immigrants. I mean, otherwise, what is the one doesn't exist without the other in this very dialectical oppressive tension, which is also a tension that produces resistance. The deployment of ableist language to create affect among audiences at the expense of disabled people. You know? So, yes, the histories behind these deployments are really torturous. They are real. They are part of a history that's been mostly erased from dominant understandings of the body. And those are the histories of the asylum in conjunction with the birth of psychiatry in the 19th century, scientific racism, and the production, the systematic production of these labels that would then determine humanity and non-humanity, humanity and subhumanity.
So you can support KPFK and our show today, Feminist Magazine. Just go to the kpfk.org website and click that donate button or call 818-985-5735 or 818-985-KPFK. And that is just one example of the kind of story we love to highlight. Feminist Magazine brings you voices like that, and also feminist artists and creatives, plus, of course, local activists telling you ways that you can take action, you know, grassroots action, and make a difference yourself. That is what we actually mean when we say at the top of our show every week that we're bringing you a mix of intersectional stories and guests to help you resist and engage. So during this fund drive, and we're limiting the number of interruptions and preemptions so that your favorite programs like this one can keep going on the air, providing you with the information and the news that you can only get on KPFK. So please show your support for the station and for this approach. We want you to kind of vote with your actions and say, yeah, we want to keep having programming. But the way we'll know that is if you support us. We want to keep doing this approach to fundraising, but you can do your part by pledging online, kpfk.org, or call 818-985-5735. If it's been a while since you last donated, even if you've never donated before, if you've been listening but you've never donated before, there's no time like the present. Don't procrastinate. So do it now and make a generous donation, as generous as you can, to keep KPFK part of your daily life, to keep Feminist Magazine part of your weekly life. We're in challenging times and your contribution really is vitally important. So we thank you for your help and support. We thank you on behalf of all of the other listeners and all of us right here at KPFK. We work as a collective of diverse voices and contributors. And like that whole thing of diverse voices is not just a set of differences, but a way to kind of come together, collaborate, and make something bigger and better. And that's what we do on our show, Feminist Magazine. And that's what KPFK does as well. So it means that there's a bunch of viewpoints giving you, our listeners, all kinds of perspectives, stories, and guests every week. Be a sustainer. And that is amazing. You give us your credit card. You say how much you want to donate every month. And then it's automatically taken out. You don't have to worry about it. We have a sustainable base that we can work from, that we can build from. Go to kpfk.org and click that donate button right now to support the show. And now is your last chance to support KPFK in this hour. So if you like what you just heard on Feminist Magazine, please support us to keep doing that. kpfk.org or call 818-985-5735. And thank you.
On Saturday, May 9th, KPFK 90.7 FM presents Sumud, a celebration of Palestinian culture, resistance, and solidarity. A fundraiser for KPFK, 4 to 8 p.m. in the Mid-Wilshire area of Los Angeles. Presenting Chris Maltz of the Amazon Labor Union and Nidal Rafidi, Vice President of Teamsters Local 1932, in a live panel on labor and Palestine, hosted by comedian Amir Zahir. You can join us at this event. More information at kpfk.org.
Soy Gregorio Luque y estás escuchando KPFK 90.